Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Larry Marks, Chair of Radiation Oncology at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, about the use of radiation therapy in the treatment of cancer. Christy, this is going to be the first of a four-part series that we're going to be talking on the new faces of cancer care. I think it'll be really interesting.
I think it'll be great to have some of our cancer doctors with us, especially all in a row.
Yep. Well, but first, we actually have some new research that matters today, and we also have one of our special guests returning today.
We do. Dr. Ronnie Laney will be with us doing a new segment that we're bringing back called Weekend Warriors. But first, let's jump into some research that matters, Adam. We've got one on pap smears and new guidelines about that.
Well, yes, for all of our female listeners out there, this is relevant to you. As you may know, coming in to see your primary care providers over the last year or two, you probably have noticed some differences in how frequently your primary care providers are getting pap smears on you.
And in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, these new guidelines were published highlighting some of the recent recommendations, particularly ones that were changed as recently as November 2009.
So that for women between the ages of 21 to 30, assuming that you have no other really adverse things going on that might make you get pap smears more frequently, you can get pap smears every other year.
And for women who are 30 and older, they can be screened once every 3 years. And the most significant thing is that for young women less than 21 years of age, the recommendation has changed to say that it's better not to do any pap smears at all below the age of 21.
Yeah, and it used to be that you would start 3 years after a woman first became sexually active. And so for a lot of our patients, unfortunately, that might mean they were getting pap smears, you know, when they were 17, 16, 18. And this could be pretty traumatic, take them out of school, take them out of all kinds of situations. And because the causative virus in cervical cancer is very, very slow growing, it really decided that it wasn't worth it and didn't need to be done.
Well, and most of the abnormal pap smears that we discovered in these younger women would clear on their own. And so it brought a lot of extra testing and harm and treatment to people who, in the end, probably didn't need it. So now the pap smears don't start until you're 21 years or older, and they're not nearly as frequent as we had to do before.
So good news, and more good news if you're a woman out there. So maybe the men will get by with less prostate exams down the road. We'll see. What's our next research that matters?
Our next one is about HIV testing, trying to find different ways to discover new infections. The bottom line is we have 100 million Americans who are HIV positive right now, and it's estimated that about
1 million. Right?
Not 100 million. Did I say 100?
You said 100 million. That would be a lot.
That would be a lot. 1 million. Excuse me. 1 million is still a lot of Americans are HIV positive, and an estimated 230,000 Americans currently have undiagnosed HIV.
Yeah, I think just thinking about the 1 million number, that's just a huge number. You know, one out of, 30. You know, or one out of 300 Americans, because over a little over 300 million Americans, so, you know, have HIV disease. And this article in the Journal of the American Medical Association was, you know, what should we do? Because there's, like you mentioned, Christy, there's over 200,000 that aren't diagnosed but yet have it. And can we diagnose them? And what we've been told is that, well, we should just screen everyone. Everyone, when they come in to see a doctor, when they go to the emergency room, they should just get screened so we can detect this undiagnosed HIV, because it actually would help people by saving lives if they were diagnosed earlier with the good treatments that we have now.
Exactly.
But what did they find here?
Well, this was kind of disappointing. Basically, they studied what's called opt-out testing on patients who come to the ER, meaning everybody who comes in, they say, well, we'd like to test you for HIV unless you tell us not to.
And unfortunately, out of the 25,000 people who they went to that for, three-quarters of them said, nope, not me. Don't test me.
Exactly. So only a quarter of them got the test. And they They compared that to a different approach using standard risk factors in a patient group about the same size and found and discovered about the same number of HIV-positive patients. So basically,
the standard approach didn't help. Well, they found four in those who had risk factors. That still means they found six that wouldn't have been found. And they made it sound like that wasn't such a big thing, but I don't know, six undiagnosed ones that you wouldn't have found otherwise in 7,000 screened patients. I mean, I don't know that. I guess I was a little bit less pessimistic than they were about their own research.
Well, I guess they were looking at the 28,000 patients
who were, but only a quarter of those agreed, right? So three quarters disagreed to be tested. So it's hard to know. I mean, for those that got diagnosed, I bet this was a good thing that they found out, I would
sure.
think.
Oh, well, sure.
I mean, if I had it, I'd want to know about it.
Well, we know that people will transmit it less, so it saves other lives of people that they could have infected had they not known that they had the virus. And earlier treatment makes a big difference. So,
we should be promoting screening, but recognize that until the cost maybe comes down a lot, we really have to find ways to encourage people to want to get screened.
Exactly. Break down those barriers. But now,
speaking about things that people want to do, Christy and I want to bring back on Research That Matters, Important Things That Matters. We want to bring back our Weekend Warrior talking about some really important research on orthopedic injuries.
So we're bringing back Dr. Ronnie Laney for a segment called Weekend Warriors, and he is one of our resident physicians at UNC. And I'm so glad to have you back today, Dr. Laney.
I'm so happy to be back, Adam and Christy.
What kind of crazy story do you have for us today?
Well, first we're going to discuss concussions. And as always, I bring back one of these great studies, stories of what people do to injure themselves. But just I want to point out, too, the serious nature of concussions, though. They do have long-term effects in contact sports and in soldiers as well.
But, well, this is important because we're about to enter into football season, right?
Absolutely, Adam.
High school football around the state of North Carolina, college football in our universities, and professional football, and even in our hockey players. I've been reading about all this past year about the serious nature of concussions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Adam.
So tell us a story.
So the story actually starts off a little more close to home. A couple of buddies of mine, we actually get together and play guitar and play real actual rock band every now and then. We have a full drum set and some guitars. And so some of us are kind of Who fans. So the Who were known for destroying their sets at the end of their gigs and throwing guitars and kicking drums. And so
you guys didn't hit each other with your guitars, did you?
Well, not intentionally, Adam, but we were trying to recreate the scene and kicking. Well, we didn't destroy the guitars because we don't have that much money. But somewhere during the melee, one flying guitar struck another buddy of mine in the back of the head.
Ouch. Yes. Ouch. But it was more than ouch.
It was more than ouch, yes.
What happened?
He's actually okay. He actually did not lose consciousness, but I think he was a little dazed for a while.
So he got a little dazed, and we'd call that maybe a concussion because of the dazingness and maybe a little confusion or
A little amnesia before and after the event.
So Okay. Break it down for us, Ronnie. We always hear about head injuries, concussions. Some people think, well, that only means if you pass out. Or tell us, what is it? What is a concussion?
So a concussion is defined actually by a consensus statement, a group of orthopedists and family medicine docs and neurologists actually got together and tried to define concussion. And they used a bunch of large words, really, that said they defined it as a pathophysiological process that affects the brain due to biomechanical forces, either indirect and direct. And basically what that really means, it's a constellation of symptoms that occurs after some sort of head injury.
So
symptoms include things like headache, nausea, and vomiting. There may or may not be loss of consciousness, as we just discussed already. Confusion and amnesia actually is a big part of it, and this can be either retrograde amnesia, so forgetting things that happened before the injury, or anterograde amnesia, forgetting new things, but also other things such as emotionality out of proportion, changes in mood, changes in concentration, and even changes in motor skills.
So this is obviously a huge problem, not just for folks like you and your guitar buddies, our weekend warriors, so to speak, but it is for all of the professional and also lay athletes who are out there doing all kinds of high endurance sports and high impact sports, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, most athletes start very early on. And so this is actually a problem that begins in the high school level, the college level, even actually before even the JV level. So if if an athlete experiences a concussion earlier on in their career, they're now at risk, we know now, for repeated concussions, and there are long-term sequelae that occur from this that actually garners a lot of public attention now.
So that is, I mean, that is what parents want to know, that is what the players want to know, is what, I've gotten bumped on the head, maybe I had some of these symptoms, then what does that mean for my life? Does that, what are the long-term effects from that, from mm-hmm. one versus two versus more?
And so three areas that kind of are addressed in that question are, number one, there's a very serious, but although it's a rare condition, called second impact syndrome. And that actually kind of guides a lot of our management of concussions. And then also return to play. So the athlete wants to know, well, how soon can I get back out there? And then the public wants to know, especially parents, well, what are the long-term effects of these repeated concussions? And we know now that there are things such as post-traumatic epilepsy. And Dr. Harry Stafford,
Seizures, absolutely.
And Dr. Harry Stafford, I was talking about a new studies in NFL players that show there's an increased risk, incidence of depression among athletes who have suffered multiple concussions. And there's also things like severe traumatic brain injury that actually leads to decreased mentation and thinking.
So if we have any listeners out there who have loved ones or children or parents or grandparents or anyone who's had concussions, feel free to write us, send us in some information, share some stories. We'll run these past Dr. Laney and talk about them with you, because I think this is an important issue. I know we're going to have you back on a show upcoming again, and maybe we can talk some more about these concussions. And I think also next time you're going to be also talking a little bit about arthritis, right? We're going to start talking a little bit about arthritis and the knees and joints.
That's correct, for all of us adults.
Can't wait to hear that story. Thank you so much for bringing us some stories of the weekend warrior.
All right. We are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Larry Marks about the use of radiation therapy in the treatment of cancer. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're introducing the first of what will be a four-part series on the faces of cancer care. This is something that UNC hospitals and UNC Cancer Hospital has really been promoting. And Christy and I began thinking about it, that there really is some really important research happening around cancer and cancer care at UNC and around the country. And we wanted to bring some of this new knowledge to you. And we are starting out that with really our first conversation about radiation therapy and its role in cancer care.
And we would like to welcome Dr. Larry Marks. Dr. Marks is professor and chief of the Department of Radiation Oncology at UNC. Dr. Marks is a recognized expert in the treatment of patients with breast and lung cancer and conducts research on applying innovative technology to improve radiation treatment. Regarded as one of the country's top breast cancer specialists, Dr. Marks came to UNC in 2008 from Duke University, where he had been a member of the radiation oncology faculty since 1989. He attended medical school at the University of Rochester in New York. And we are so grateful to have you with us today, Dr. Marks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, one of the things that we're going to be jumping in just a second and talking about radiation therapy and breast cancer and lung cancer, two of the most common cancers really that affect people. But Christy and I always want to know, you know, how did you get interested in radiation therapy? I mean, this is not one of those things. I remember going through medical school, and it wasn't one of the things I was necessarily exposed to, and I probably didn't even know much about it until I got into residency that I even knew about it. How did you get interested in this particular field?
Oh, and especially since your background was in engineering, as I read through your resume, it did strike me as a different path than many physicians.
Well, as you note, I was an engineer. I was a chemical engineer undergrad, and that's where I met my wife in engineering school. And we both went to medical school together, and I was having a hard time in medical school. I missed the science and the math and the quantitative nature of engineering, because medicine, as you both know, is often somewhat qualitative and not as quantitative as we might like. And I was very frustrated with that. And just when I was thinking about dropping out of medical school and not doing a residency, my wife came back from school one day and said, you know, you should go talk to this guy. He was something like a radiation oncologist, I think is what he said. And she said, he spoke, and I think you'd like what he does. So indeed, I went and I met with some folks, and I got interested in radiation oncology, and it's a wonderful field for someone who's interested in math and physics and those sorts of quantitative things. You clearly don't need to be interested in those things to be a successful radiation oncologist. You need to at least be able to tolerate them. But I found that radiation oncology is a great field for me because I was able to worry about angles and geometry and math and algebra and things like that, which I use fairly routinely in my job. So the engineering and radiation ecology actually do have a fairly good link, and through the quantitative nature and science and math.
That's great. Well, we're glad you found your way, and then you found your way to UNC, and we're grateful for that too. What brought you to UNC?
Oh, well, that's an interesting sort of story. I was at Duke for almost 20 years and had a very, very good time at Duke, and really enjoyed my many years there, worked with many, many wonderful people. And I was offered a good job at UNC. Basically, it was an opportunity to do something different, a personal growth experience on many levels. So it was an opportunity to do a different job, work in a different environment, and an opportunity to do something good for the people of North Carolina and to work at a different institution. It was a new challenge for me.
Well, I know we are the beneficiaries of that at UNC, and I know that Duke had the benefits of your expertise for many years there. And I guess one of the questions, just helping our listeners understand the field of radiation oncology concisely, what do you deal with on a daily basis? What is the role of radiation oncology in what is a multidisciplinary treatment of cancer?
Yeah. So radiation therapy or radiation oncology is a relatively small field. There's only several thousand of us in the country. So what you mentioned before, how you maybe didn't hear of the field at all in medical school, that's very typical. Most medical students have very little exposure to radiation oncology. We try to be involved in the curriculum so that we can have some exposure with the medical
students. But every patient with cancer just about does come into contact with radiation oncology.
Roughly half or so
half.
Patients
okay, that's
with
a lot.
Cancer will come in contact with radiation therapists. So what we do, we treat almost exclusively malignant diseases or cancers. There are a variety of benign diseases that we treat with radiation as well, but that makes up a minority of a particular radiation oncologist practice. So a typical radiation oncologist spends most of the time seeing and evaluating patients. It's a very clinical field, so we would evaluate a patient typically at the time of diagnosis. When we work with other members of the healthcare team to plan a strategy of treatment for that patient. As you mentioned, cancer is complicated. It's a lot of different diseases, and there are many different treatments for different diseases. And for each patient, you have to assess the different treatment options, and we work with our colleagues in medical oncology and surgical oncology and other disciplines, genetics, nutrition, social work, et cetera, to figure out what we think is the best treatment for any individual patient. So radiation, let me give you the big picture. So cancer is a problem for mainly two reasons. Cancer can grow in its local area where it started, or it could spread elsewhere in the body. The elsewhere in the body is usually dealt with by systemic therapies, chemotherapy or hormonal therapy or targeted agents, things that go in your bloodstream or you take by pill and get absorbed into your bloodstream that go through your whole body. We call those systemic therapies. Radiation, much like surgery, is a local treatment. So most cancers require both a local treatment and a systemic treatment.
So when you apply radiation and decide, okay, so this is an area of cancer that radiation is appropriate to try to basically kill that cancer, those cancer cells, one of the problems, as I understand it, is that then you can damage the normal tissue that's around it. And I understand you've been doing some important research in the area to figure out how to decrease the damage to the normal tissue in the body from radiation and really target it towards those cancer cells that you're trying to get at. How does that work?
And even let's be even more focused. If you could maybe even talk about a case of breast cancer, for instance, how does this work and how do you protect that normal tissue that Christy talks about?
Okay. Let me back up and say that all treatments have potential side effects. And when you give chemotherapy, the good thing about chemotherapy is it goes in the whole body and can sterilize cancer cells that are anywhere in the body. But that's also the bad thing about chemotherapy. It can go anywhere as well. So there are toxicities of any treatment.
Sure.
And it's always a balance to do that. And same thing for surgery. There are always side effects of treatments, and radiation is really, really no different.
And we're going to talk about that. After our break, we're going to talk about some of the side effects, because there was this whole New York Times expose about this, and it's really difficult. So I know we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Okay. So let me just give answer to the particular example you raised about breast cancer. So with breast cancer, we typically aim radiation fields at the breast from a variety of directions to try to minimize the amount of normal tissue that gets exposed to the radiation, at the same time providing adequate coverage of the target tissues, typically the breast for patients with breast cancer, sometimes the lymph nodes as well in the vicinity. So we spend a lot of time figuring out what the optimal orientation or direction of the radiation should be. And then we shape the radiation beam so that it has particular shapes to try to better conform to the shape of the breast that you're trying to treat. So for breast cancer, we worry about the breast itself, the ribs, the nerves, the lung, the muscle, the soft tissue.
Protecting all of those.
So we try to protect all of those. One of the main things we do in terms of protecting those structures is giving the radiation a little bit at a time. So typically when a patient comes in for radiation treatment, they'll come in every day for a series of three weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. It might be Monday to Friday for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, or 6 weeks, something like that. And one of the main reasons we do that is because by giving the radiation a little bit at a time each day, the normal tissues appear to tolerate that better. So we can improve what we call the therapeutic ratio, which is the ratio of how much cancer killing do you do divided by how much normal tissue risk do you expose the patient to. You can maximize that ratio by fractionating or giving the treatment in many small doses.
Well, I see the science coming in here, and I also see that how your mind is. But I also see that you didn't escape the qualitative aspect, because if you're seeing these patients back frequently over time, you've had to deal lots and serious illnesses with the qualitative aspect. And maybe after a break, we can talk a little bit about what it's like for you to care for really sick patients and combining potentially toxic therapies, and how do you deal with these things and your colleagues. But we need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Larry Marks, Division Chief of the Department of Radiation Oncology at UNC Cancer Hospitals. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Larry Marks, Chair of Radiation Oncology at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Marks, one of the things Adam was just commenting on is the qualitative aspect of your field and your day-to-day work. And certainly the science and the engineering and the physics and all of your background that led you to become a radiation oncologist is part of your day-to-day work. But you're really, if you're seeing people back every day, you are taking care of some very sick people in real relationships. What is that like for you?
Well, being a cancer physician is really a privilege. We get to take care and get to interact with people during a very vulnerable time in their lives when they're facing a life-threatening illness. And all of us in radiation oncology and medical oncology and surgical oncology and all of the staff, the nurses, the navigators, the social workers, are an incredibly dedicated group of people that really feel strongly for the patients and advocate for the patients. And it's really a privilege dealing with patients during this critical time. And we can offer them often a chance of cure. And even if not a chance of cure, a chance of palliation, of helping their symptoms get better, a hope to improve either short-term or long-term. And it's really a wonderful field because the stakes are very high. You know, and I remember in medical school, you did different rotations, and no offense to family medicine, but you know, a lot of what I did when I was on family medicine, it was interesting and it was important, but much of it were things that would sort of get better on their own, often, and I was attracted to surgery when I was a medical student. I liked the The invasiveness.
A chance to cut is a chance to cure.
Well, it was a very,
as our colleagues, surgical colleagues, like to say. Yes,
you felt as if you were doing something very invasive. But the thing I didn't like about surgery was, you know, you're in the OR, you stand there, your hands are bloody, and you got to make a decision right then. Radiation oncologists sort of like that, but I get to say time out. I get to go look something up, so I could be planning a radiation field on somebody, planning what to do, and I could say, wait a minute, I'm not sure of that. I'm going to go look it up, and I literally would get up, I'll look something up, or I'll get a colleague's opinion. So radiation is sort of like slow motion surgery. It's very invasive and it's very high stakes, and there are risks involved, as we'll discuss. Let's talk about that high stakes and those risks,
because I think, you know, one of the perceptions that many people have or had, and maybe even I as a provider had, is, well, radiation therapy, yes, it's high beam radiation, but it's safe. You guys have all these quality control measures that can precisely and in detail and keep patients safe from getting, you know, scarring of their lungs or heart or burning in the skin. But there was this New York Times expose a couple months ago that really maybe changed a lot of people's perspectives about problems within the field. And predominantly what it appeared to me is human errors. Can you talk a little bit about that article and how true or not true some of the problems they describe?
So first thing is that I'd say 99.99%+ of patients are treated appropriately and safely. And the perception that that we do things extremely accurately and extremely precisely is correct. All right. We have a very high-tech field where we do an enormous amount of quality assurance and safety measures in our daily work to make sure that treatment is given appropriately.
Can you give an example? What do you do to kind of protect people? What's a safety mechanism?
Every day the output of the machine is verified,
okay,
for example. And then we do more in-depth calibrations of the machine.
So what you think you're giving is what's being given.
Correct. And there are national standards. You irradiate a phantom and you send that phantom to a central office in Houston, and that office tells you how much radiation. Well, you tell Houston how much you think you gave.
Oh, wow.
And then Houston says right or wrong.
Well, what about if you wanted to give 1,000 units of a dose, and what protects if the person entering it enters in 10,000 or 100? Are there safeguards against that type of human error?
Yes, there are. And like any field, there certainly are opportunities for mistakes to be made. But we go to great lengths, as do most institutions, to have multiple checks and balances in our systems. So I'm fortunate to work with many highly skilled dosimetrists and physicists and therapists who work very hard to assure that what I want to prescribe as the physician is indeed what is being delivered to the patient. In addition, the physicians, we check each other as well. Every morning, we have a morning meeting where we go over the cases that are about to be planned, and we check what each other is planning to do. So on the physician level, we have quality assurance and peer review.
So why do mistakes occur then? And it sounds like you've also are interested in research to try to change that. What are the mistakes from, and what are you doing and others doing to try to change that?
So the stories in the New York Times were tragic stories of terrible things that happened to a relatively few number of patients in light of the large number of patients who receive radiation therapy throughout the country, and in that case, in those centers in New York. Those unfortunate cases were instances where there were a series of mistakes that fell through the usual quality assurance systems that were set up at those hospitals. And those articles were eye-opening, and they were very concerning. You know, many of us went back and reassessed how we do our quality assurance methods, and we made some minor adjustments here or there to make our systems more robust. So I think we all pretty much have very robust systems, and they're in constant evolution to make the systems more robust. What happened in those cases in New York, at least some of them, were that there were some new technologies introduced into the clinics, and the existing quality assurance safeguards did not necessarily keep up well enough with those new techniques that were being implemented in the clinic. These mistakes were terrible, tragic events that resulted from a series of mistakes and things falling through the cracks, which it's not an excuse, but could certainly happen in many areas, areas of life.
Well, keeping that in mind, I mean, technology is going to continue to advance. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a medical community, whether it's in radiation oncology or anything else, we need to continue to create new systems for new technologies that will keep up So how do we do that in a, on a system level to make sure that those sorts of mistakes don't happen again?
It's a great question. That's an ongoing challenge for all of us. So I'm involved. I'm on some national committees about patient safety, involved in some research activities related to safety as well. I think one of the challenges for us is to incorporate safety into the culture of how we train physicians, incorporate safety safeguards into the software that we use on a daily basis. So instead of there being, here's my software for I'm going to treat patients on the one hand, and I'm going to have a separate tool that I'm going to use for quality assurance, in many areas in medicine, these are two separate things. You have what you're doing, and you have the checks on what you're doing. And what we need to do is work better to integrate those things together. So, for example, we use software to plan our radiation treatments. And what the challenge is for us is to modify that software and add features to that software to make quality assurance, make safety an integral component, or more of an integral component in those in that software.
So when you have a new technology, maybe to get approval, instead of just saying, hey, it works, you have to also say, hey, it works, and here's how we keep it safe.
Sure.
It could be that simple.
It's also instilling in the health system this culture of safety and this culture where people should feel comfortable challenging, people should feel comfortable raising concerns and bringing up questions. This is not just in radiation oncology, this is broadly throughout medicine. There's been some very prominent books that came up in the last year or two discussing this, in particular Dr. Provenos' book talking about the culture of safety in medical education and residency. These are critical
well,
things.
I know this whole notion of patient safety is a critical one across the country here in the Triangle. It's one that's relevant to family physicians, to radiation oncologists, to surgeons, hospital administrators. It's really fascinating to hear you as the chair of a department embracing and really making this a central focus, because it really is empowering in this network and partnership with patients. I know we're going to have to break soon, but before we leave, I do just want to have you just say a moment about, you also have an interesting hobby, and the changing face of cancer care is about people and their work, and you do something unusual because I've heard you play piano. Tell us a little bit, just at the end, how is it that a radiation oncologist is a really good, really good piano player?
Well, thank you. I don't know that I consider myself really good. My family doesn't think I'm really good either. I really enjoy playing piano. It's one of those, it's an outlet for me. I get to bang on the keys and make a lot of noise. And I've always enjoyed music. My father is a wonderful singer. We always had music in the family. And my brother is a musician. My three sons played piano. My youngest still plays the trumpet. So we have a fair amount of music in the house. My wife Karen appreciates music, so I get to play and they tolerate me. But thank you for the kind words. I love playing music. I particularly like playing show tunes, and I get a lot of joy from
well, it sounds like
piano.
your passion for medicine is also a passion for music, and that's a passion for helping people to get better. So we need to really thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Larry Marks, Chair of Radiation Oncology at the North Carolina Cancer Hospital. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Well, coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your questions and experiences and attitudes towards medical care. We want you to write us and share these with us.
You know, Christy, we will address these on an upcoming show and give our thoughts and opinions. You can send them, your comments, to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 919-966-8081. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us some of our house calls today. What's up, Julie?
Our first listener writes, I have poison ivy on my hands, although I'm not sure how I got it, as I used gloves when pulling weeds. I'm really allergic. It looks bad, and to help it heal, I rub the blisters to get all the fluid out. I'm leaving it in the sun some to let it dry out. It is still painful, but I think this treatment is helping. Is this something you would recommend to others?
No, 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 no. Well, I think we know how you got the poison ivy, even though you use gloves. Because I think if I had a nickel, Christy, for every person who says they, you know, they don't know how they got it, then I'd be a rich man. Because you got it because that oil from the leaf got on your skin, probably from the gloves when you took them off.
And rubbing it and leaving it out in the sun to dry is not something that I routinely recommend. I usually recommend to people to try to wash. Some people recommend using rubbing alcohol or water, but as soon as possible after you think you have been exposed, to see if you can get the oil off. But remembering that it could be on your clothes, it can still be on the areas of your hands. And so as you rub your body, you know, really try to avoid touching your face or spreading that oil anywhere else.
Well, you know, and the problem with rubbing the blisters to get all the fluid out is you rubbed them so raw that you caused pain. And pain is a better sensation than itching, but the problem is that you're much more likely to get these blisters infected now. Mm-hmm. And the real treatment is, as Christy mentioned, there's different products you can take as soon as you are exposed to actually get rid of and inactivate the chemical that's going to cause the skin reaction. But once it's there, even you could use some a topical steroid or even ice to cut down the inflammation because we don't want to risk an infection.
There are people who say that itching can be improved by using a hot shower or even blowing a hairdryer. Just heat on that area can give you some relief from the itching. But I wouldn't rub those blisters off and put them in the sun. Although it does sound like you're getting better, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, time will get better too. And for anyone who wants more information, I'm going to encourage you to do something which I'm not going to do very often on this show. Google, put these words into the Google search term: Adam Goldstein, poison ivy, and Google. Put those three search terms together, and you'll come up with, Christy, an article that I've written for Google Magazine. I'm their go-to personal poison ivy.
I don't normally famous for poison ivy.
Yeah, that and scabies, unfortunately. Don't want to be known by these. But, Julie, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 35-year-old woman who has fibromyalgia as well as chronic fatigue syndrome. Many doctors I see still don't believe that either condition is real, and they want to treat me for depression. Yes, I am depressed, but it is because of the constant pain and fatigue I have, and it is worse when doctors discount it and me. What do you think?
Well, I'd say thank you for sharing this with me. And to me, when I hear this, it sounds more of a trust and a communication issue between you and the doctor or doctors that you've seen. It's one of those tough things because depression and fibromyalgia and chronic pain can be related in that it's more common for you to have more than one of those than one alone. So the doctor may be bringing up depression, but it may not be that the doctor doesn't think you're actually having pain or that it's all in your head. So it may be a matter of communication. What do you think, Adam?
And this is an evolution. And so, you know, if you asked us 10 years ago about chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, probably a lot of doctors would have said, I'm not sure those things are real. But now you see more and more written about them and in the medical textbooks. But we also don't know a lot about those still. And so it's really frustrating, not just for you who has to deal with this on a daily basis, but it's frustrating for doctors too, because sometimes we don't know how best to help patients such as yourself. So I agree, Christy, though. I think this is – it's about communication at the very least.
And developing a relationship with a doctor who will see you through time and work with you to try to make those symptoms better and validate the fact that you do hurt and that is can really influence your life. So – I would encourage you to talk with your doctor about your feelings that he's discounting or she's discounting the illness. And if you can't get it with that doctor, find a new one.
But hopefully get to a better place. And maybe you're educating the doctor and the doctor will be more empathetic and you guys have a new place to get to.
Mm-hmm.
What do we have next?
What do we have next?
My father is 62 years old and has had high blood pressure for 10 years. He takes a daily aspirin and exercises pretty regularly. His father died from a heart attack at age 63, and my father thinks he might have one at that age, too. A friend of ours suggested that we talk with our family physician about having an implantable defibrillator placed in my father, that it could save his life if he had a heart attack. Is this a good idea?
Well, it's a great question.
It is a great question.
I'm not sure it's a good idea, but it's a great question.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say it sounds like if your father is 62 and he's had high blood pressure that's been controlled, he's taken a daily aspirin, he's doing the things, and he exercises, he's already doing the things that he should be doing to prevent what happened to his father.
And there's a lot more research out today about implantable defibrillators and what's known and not known. And we can summarize it real briefly, but, you know, there is the kind of the main indication that people hear about, which is people who've had a heart attack, cardiac arrest, or have recurrent ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia, has really bad rhythms that can lead to death. Those people, good candidates for this implantable defibrillator.
But if he doesn't have any significant heart problems and haven't had any problems with rhythms of his heart, then having that placed would not necessarily be...
Unless he also has a pretty severe congestive heart failure or is having these pretty severe symptoms, which we didn't hear about. So
right. Thank you for
probably
the question.
Not indicated, but a great question.
Mm-hmm. So we've had a chance to talk a little bit about implantable defibrillators,
about not rubbing that skin off to make it raw on the hands for poison ivy.
And a little bit about fibromyalgia and relationship and talking with your doctor about that. Thank you so much for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. And we want you to share your questions and experiences by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or calling us at 919-966-8081. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
Lots of ways, Christy, to get in touch with us. We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great producer, Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Larry Marks. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.